from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. This is Behind the Markets on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111.
Welcome to Behind the Markets here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz, Director of Research at WisdomTree, and we're broadcasting live from New York City today. We're at the Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, attending the annual Jacobs Levy Equity Management Center Forum here in New York. My co-host, Wharton Finance Professor Jeremy Siegel, he's in our studio at the Wharton School in Philadelphia. Please note that I'm a registered representative of Foreside Fund Services, and Professor Siegel is a senior advisor to WisdomTree. Our discussion today is not a recommendation for any trading strategies, nor tied to the offer of any investment products. Views our guests are their own and not those of WisdomTree. Professor, really, what a special show we have today from the Jacobs Levy Center here. We're going to have the academic director of the Jacobs Levy Center, Chris Gakesy, who's going to be here to discuss the program. But our sort of honored guest is Bill Sharpe, who's Nobel laureate. He's winning an award here at the conference for his work in style analysis. So it's going to have him for an extended conversation. It's really an honor to be here.
Yes, it'll be our second Nobel laureate that we've had on our SiriusXM radio show. When we first began, which I guess was about 2 years ago, we had Robert Shore just before he was off to Stockholm to accept his Nobel Prize. So I'm very, very proud and thrilled today that Bill Sharpe, also one of the founders in the theory of finance, is going to be with us later on in the program.
Yeah, so before we get to our two guests here, why don't we just sort of start with our typical market review? It's been a lot of discussion on Fed policy coming up in a few weeks. We'll have the June meeting, and we got the minutes from the last meeting. That's what everybody is focused on right now.
Absolutely. Normally, the minutes don't cause as much of a stir as they did on Wednesday. But when the words came out that not many or quite a few, but most FOMC members thought it was appropriate to continue the normalization of monetary policy, I mean, means the continued rise in interest rates if the economy bounces back as expected. So let's talk a little bit about what that means. We had a terrible first quarter. As you know, the first read on GDP in the first quarter was just 0.5%. Now, as data has come in, it looks a little bit stronger. We might get up to 1%. That's still not great. But the read in the second quarter is much better. Not booming by any means, but we're getting reads of GDP in the second quarter of between 2 and 2.5%, and that's pretty much on what the Fed targets. So it is bouncing back. So the data says, "Oh wow!" And don't forget, this was 3 weeks ago, but the data that's come through since gives us confidence that the economy has bounced back from that extremely slow first quarter. So now we have a month, not quite a month. I mean, June 15th will be the decision. So there's a lot of data to go. We have another very important payroll report. We have several inflation reports. And so certainly it is nowhere near a done deal. But unless the data comes in very weak, it appears like the Fed is ready to hike in the June meeting. Now, let's talk a little bit about the probabilities and what the market says. We've often pointed out on the program that the Fed Funds Futures, which is used universally by the news services and many of the analysts to derive the probability of what the Fed is going to do at subsequent meetings, is biased. It is biased towards no move. And this has to do with the risk correlations. We won't go into it today, that these contracts have with other variables. So what we see is that you look there and they say, well, maybe 30% chance, 25, 30, 35. But the true probability, I think, has now moved to over 50%. And with those words, the Dow, which was up 100 points just before that 2 p.m. release, well, it went down 200 points to a minus 100 points. Was quite volatile throughout Wednesday and Thursday. Hey, today it's up 100. So at this particular juncture, the market is saying maybe they're going to hike, but maybe this isn't the worst news that we could have, especially for the equity market, because the Fed would only hike if they thought the economy was getting stronger. They're not going to hike into a weak economy. And so maybe we shouldn't fear a mere 25 basis point increase in Fed funds from the current quarter to 50 basis to 50 to 75. Maybe we should put more stock in the implications of a stronger economy. So as you can see, there's a lot of mix emotion here in the market, and that's going to be the struggle, I think, that's going to go on until we actually do have that meeting.
Yeah, you've often said that it's not the first or second hike that really derails your bear market, the bull market. It's really as you get past the fourth, fifth, and into the longer number of hikes.
I remember saying, you know, when that taper tantrum, this is when Ben Bernanke years ago said, you know, we may stop QE in the future, and the market panicked. And I said, hey, guys, he's just saying stopping QE. A rate hike is at least a year or two down, and the bear markets don't start on the first rate hike anyways. And the market has, in fact, moved up quite a bit since that so-called taper tantrum that took place during the Bernanke. But you're perfectly right, Jeremy, and this is what I've said. Bear markets do not end on the first, second, or third hike of the Fed funds. It's really toward the end of the cycle when they've really hiked up high and, you know, they're fighting in inflationary pressures that we really begin to worry a bit about, you know, what the stock market's going to do.
Now, a lot of people say that, you know, they weren't going to hike because you've got the Brexit meeting right after, and then people say as we get to September they're not going to hike because we have the election. I mean, how much do these political and sort of global political concerns do you think actually come into play?
I personally think that the Brexit vote, which is coming, I guess, a week or 10 days after the Fed meeting, is not going to be a really decisive factor. First of all, things are looking better for the stay in EU, at least in the betting markets. Odds are now actually creeping up to almost 3-1. Now, obviously, things can change, you know, between now and that vote. So there's a little bit more certainty that the vote will come out favorable for them to stay. But I honestly don't think that, I mean, the Fed has got to be looking towards its domestic normalization. Yes, they worry about global events when they really roil the markets, like what was happening with China late last year and in January. And that really took their notice, to say the least. I don't really think Brexit is going to be important. Now, you also bring up what's going to happen, you know, the November elections coming on. And a lot of people are saying, you know, they want to get one done in June, and then they may hold off in September. That's still too far away to know. They don't know. What kind of data are we going to get between you know, now and those November meetings? Again, the inflation data has not been coming in terrible in the sense of oh my goodness, look at those inflationary consequences. But they also, there's no question that prices have firmed up. As I've mentioned before, I think we definitely put in a bottom in commodity prices in the first week of February. We put a bottom in on oil prices when it hit $26 a barrel, you know, and now is considerably above that, you know, near $50 a barrel. So I think that we've seen a firming of commodities, core inflation. Actually, CPI inflation year over year is over 2%, a little over their target. Now, the Fed says I'll tolerate it. A bit over the target, but these are the inflation are close enough so that I don't think it would be a deterrent for them to hike in June.
Very good, Professor. So let me just say, Chris Skeksy, a professor here at Wharton, and he's the academic director of the Jacobs Levy Equity Management Center. The forum that we're attending here in New York has just arrived in the studio. And Chris, thanks for being a return guest on our program. Thanks for hosting us at the conference here. Maybe you could just talk to our listeners a little bit background about this Jacobs Levy Equity Management Center, about the conference you're hosting today, with some of the interesting panel sessions you've already attended and what you're looking forward to for the rest of the day.
Jeremy, thank you so much for having us and for broadcasting live from the conference. It's an exciting conference for us to be hosting here in New York for a number of reasons. The Jacobs Levy Equity Management Center for Quantitative Financial Research really sits at the nexus between the academy and practice, and this is obviously an ideal location for that, although headquarters in Philadelphia are also it's wonderful to have it on campus for the obvious reasons. We support research, we foment research, we help students, we support faculty, and we try to engineer a plenum for the exchange between industry and practice. And of course, Professor Siegel, my colleague for almost 20 years
yes,
at Wharton.
Yes, long time, Chris.
And someone from whom I learn something almost every day.
Oh, thank you.
Has been a past headliner at the conference. And this year, we're particularly excited because we are giving the 2016 Wharton Jacobs Levy Prize for Quantitative Financial Innovation, in this case to Bill Sharpe. Now, Bill Sharpe, I think, is probably known to everyone in finance and economics, although perhaps not to all listeners. He's well known in some sense because he won a Nobel Prize in economics in 1990. But beyond the academic work that gave rise to the prize, he really has changed modern finance. And it's really exciting to be able to recognize at least some of his work, which, by the way, is not redundant with the Nobel Prize work, but is for work that in particular has become very important in practice.
So talk about this prize that he's winning. So you're giving out the prize. Is it every year, every 2 years? How did you think about you're on the committee for selecting the winners? Maybe what made his work? I mean, obviously he's got so much body of work, but what made it stand out?
Yeah, so, and I should importantly say that I'm ex officio on the committee, but I served along with the chair, Bruce Jacobs, John Amricks from Vanguard, Ron Kahn from BlackRock, Lubos Pastor from Chicago, and Matt Richardson from NYU. This is a prize that was established by a $2 million endowment gift by Bruce Jacobs and Ken Levy, two of our favorite sons and student former students at Wharton. It's awarded biennially to an individual or individuals who've shown excellence in quant research and that specifically has contributed to a particular innovation in the practice of finance.
So and the past winner was Harry Markowitz, is that right, Chris?
Exactly right.
So this is our second winner, right?
This is our second winner. That's right. And, you know, some might say we're following a pretty low-risk strategy of giving an award to Nobel Prize laureates. but the thing about both winners, Jeremy, is that they've done work that, of course, academically is, you know, we stand on their shoulders when we do our academic
Absolutely.
Work.
Absolutely. The founders of finance theory, capital asset pricing models, you need Markowitz and Bill Sharpe. And Bill Sharpe, obviously, I don't want to put words in his mouth. I mean, he gives a lot of credit for what he's done on the shoulders of Harry Markowitz. Didn't they win it together? Was that a joint? I'm trying to think.
1990 with Merton Miller.
Yeah,
right, they won it together.
Three of them. Merton Miller at Chicago, and then Harry Markowitz and Bill Sharpe.
The amazing thing is, Jeremy, that today we saw research papers being presented both by folks in practice and in academia showing how robust their models are, which is not always what you see, right? Because once you establish a model, you become a target.
Absolutely.
And the robustness of it has been just stunning.
The Sharpe ratio is now, you know, wow. I mean, you can't get into a discussion about, you know, what investment strategies are better than others without mentioning the Sharpe ratio, and you know that becomes that really looms large when you have a critical metric that is used by virtually every single practitioner and investor, in analyzing strategies.
Absolutely. It's the single most used, as far as I'm concerned, the single most used and prevalent statistic in the history of investment management. And it's viscerally intuitive, right?
Yeah. Well, why don't you give some of our readers might, or listeners, I should say, might not be. Could you want to describe it a little bit, Chris? I mean, on what that ratio is?
Yeah, it embodies what investors care about in a simple setting, in an intuitive setting. It's the ratio of returns to risk. Now, specifically, it's defined as the ratio of realized or expected returns on any investment or portfolio above a riskless proxy, like, say, U.S. Treasury bills. So that's called a risk premium, divided by the amount of volatility that the portfolio is expected or has historically experienced. So it's reward divided by risk. And I teach my students at Wharton that it's a unitless measure of goodness divided by badness, because it's returns divided by returns. And so it's unambiguous in most circumstances, in an all else equal sense anyway, that you like more return, you dislike risk, and so you like a higher Sharpe ratio.
Yeah. Again, risk and return are the building blocks of all of our financial strategies and the main motivators of investors. And this was a particular way to measure it. And again, the risk, without getting complicated, was really, it's the risk, not just its individual risk, but the correlation risk with the rest of the market.
That's right. You know, the Sharpe ratio embodies total risk, and then the capital asset pricing model that Bill developed relates expected returns to systematic measures of risk, which is a pricing model relative to what investors are actually holding in the world.
Right.
You know, but he's an incredible guy. You'll hear him, I think, coming up. He's done all kinds of work. He developed models for option valuation, for asset allocation optimization. And today, we're honoring him for his work on returns-based style analysis for evaluating the style and performance of investments funds. And by styles, I don't mean, you know, the kind of shoes I'm wearing right now, which aren't necessarily very stylish, but investment style, which you can see in almost any portfolio manager presentation, things like value and growth, which we in academics sometimes refer to as factors.
Mm. Yeah, you have another one of the panels. I'm just looking at your schedule here, and sort of towards the end of our session, one of the sessions you're going to be moderating, the ongoing controversy of alpha, beta, and smart beta, sort of a topic close to Professor Siegel's heart and mine. You have panelists from research affiliates in BlackRock and State Street. What's your sense from what they're going to talk about, how you're going to moderate the panel? I mean, where do you think this discussion is going in the industry?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I should footnote that you were part of our initial panel last year at last year's forum that I would say was somewhat controversial as well. What's going on in industry is that we are understanding that allocations to what we call risk factors, and that can be a huge variety of them, but things like tilts toward value or tilts toward momentum are important for returns. The debates that we're going to have, really as a continuation of the panel you were on, is going to try to isolate first definitions. Where are we 1 year later as products have increased in number and size, as the industry is responding to demand, and really ultimately define what is systematic risk and what is non-systematic risk, and whether all of this is much ado about nothing or it's really all about the future of finance. I think the industry is saying that all of this is about the future, and the future has now arrived in the form of smart beta and related concepts.
And so in your professional life outside of the professor at Wharton, I mean, how would you use these things in managing portfolios? I mean, which factors do you personally think believe in the most, this value, momentum, quality, low volatility? Any color on which factors you actually believe in?
Yeah, so the answer, academic economist, is it depends, because that's the optimal answer. return, if you call them on the one hand anomalies or whether you call them factors on the other hand, have really been around for a long time. In fact, Bill was one of the progenitors of factor models from long ago. The effects that academics have found exist in sample and out of sample are those like momentum, value, quality, which we have heard throughout the day. And at my outside activities at Forefront and Forefront Analytics and others, we actually implement them, specifically highlighting those tilts.
Hmm.
Yeah. Professor, along with carry trades and things that are related.
Yeah, when we talk about the factors, just for some of our listeners, again, in the pure capital asset pricing model, the only factor that is clearly priced is the risk, and it's the correlation with the market. And what researchers have found is there are some factors that go beyond just risk that help explain returns. So this is a little bit of the debate. You know, why are there more factors? Do we have to, why should we take these into account? Are they just artifacts of what we call data mining, is looking at all these series, or whether they really are true factors, or they represent risks that are not just risks that are correlated with the market? So these are some of the debates that I think, we've had since, as you said, we found those factors to be important above and beyond the risk. And Fama and French, of course, made it very, very popular in the late 1980s when they published the work that showed that book to market and size were two factors that accounted for returns in addition to beta.
And there's some subtleties here, Jeremy. There's an ongoing debate of what defines alpha, which is returns holding systematic risk or market risk constant, that some managers, including active managers, suggest that they can provide their clients net of fees. We actually just saw a paper by Joseph Chirakos that applied Bill's style and analytical techniques, for which he's receiving the prize today, to that question, with some surprising results, actually.
Oh. Let me welcome Bill to the program, because Bill just arrived in our makeshift studio here at the Hilton Conference. So we've got Bill Sharp. He was the Stanford professor of finance, emeritus professor there. He got his PhD at UCLA. We talked about already winning the Nobel Prize in 1990 for his work on the capital asset pricing model. Bill, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
So, Professor, any thoughts where you want to start
first
with?
First of all, congratulations, Bill, on another award. Let me just say, I remember Samuelson, also winning the Economics Award, he said, well, once you win the Nobel Prize, the amount of extra awards and honorary degrees you receive is just a function of how long you live. I'm not putting you down at all, but I thought... it is so momentous, and you certainly deserve them. We were talking about before you came how, you know, the Sharpe ratio and everything are just, you know, the common language. But I thought that Samuelson's comment there was, and you have received your share of as I look through your portfolio. So
hey, Jeremy, it's great to talk to you again. But your comment about Paul Samuelson reminds me the year after. You know, I won the prize. I was back in Stockholm, and Paul was having coffee in the morning, and he said, you know, come on over. And he said, what are you doing about the market? And I said, well, nothing.
that's great.
He was a great man, and a great wit.
Yeah. I mean, I was, honored. I was a student under him when I got my PhD at MIT, and yes. He was truly wonderful. Thank you for that memory too. There's so many things we want to talk to you about. Let me talk a little bit. You founded, still involved with Financial Engines, is that right, Bill?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Founded, but I'm totally retired.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. So. Because
let me correct the record. I was a co-founder. Three of us basically founded it.
Okay.
That is still one of the big firms giving portfolio advice.
Yeah.
I definitely want to drill into some of the new asset allocation, sort of this robo-advisor model.
Yeah, I was wondering about what you thought about that, Bill, the robo-advisor financial. I mean, these were analytical models designed to help the average person plan his or her portfolio, particularly, I guess, in the context of IRAs or pension funds, but also outside. Do you want to speak a little bit to the trends you think you see in that area?
Well, again, I'm not close to the actual practice, so I'm not fully informed. But Financial Engines found fairly early on that just a pure model of you, investor, and our machine didn't really quite cut it, especially in market downturns. People wanted someone to talk with.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So fairly early on, they established quite a substantial call center type advisory service, and they're recently, according to press releases, increasing that aspect. On the other hand, I've looked at some of the online robo-advisors, which, you know, are becoming increasingly sophisticated. And so I think there's a kind of a mixed model there. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine who founded one of the robo-advisors found that he appealed mostly to the tech millionaires that we have in the Bay Area and San Francisco area, who are perfectly happy. They've got a lot of money. They're still young, and they're very happy dealing with computerized system. I'm personally focusing most of my work now on people who have just retired and the whole decisions associated with that. And my instinct is that those folks would kind of like to talk to a human being once in a while. I mean, so some mixed model,
you know,
in the decumulation phase.
Bill and Jeremy, the question I think that seems so striking to me is, do we think that 3 million years of human experience has resulted in an app on a smartphone? I mean, there's got to be much more, right?
Well, I always say, it's a very cold hand if a robot, if you hold that. I mean, and you hit it on the head, Bill. A lot of people, I know people who only invest, let's say, in Vanguard, in index funds, and which is what we've advised. We're going to talk a little bit about that later. But they do terrible. Why? Because when the market goes down, they panic, and then they get out. So even though their selection is on and off, they can't keep it steady. They're too influenced by the up and down of sentiments. And, I think that's where the human advisor really comes up when times are bad. Hey, guys, don't panic. I've seen this before. Keep in there. And, it's very likely to get better.
I recall the first time I met Peter Bernstein when he was still advising clients, and he told me, he said, when I know what my client's true risk aversion is? And I, of course, being young and naive, said no. And he said, at 2 a.m. after the market's fallen.
Yeah, when so, they go up in panic.
That's right.
Speaking about Peter, he's wonderful. He actually wrote the foreword to my book, Stocks for the Long Run. Mm-hmm. And in that, he talked about the fact that he had sit down with someone and said, now, the market is going to go down at some time during, you understand, we're going to, keep our hands, steady here. We're not going to panic out. And he nodded his head. Sure enough, when the market was gone, he called up and said, I'm out. It's even hard for the average person. Rationally, they think they can commit themselves, but it is very, very difficult. And, when you get your emotions involved in investing, that's often when you do not do well.
I also remember Dick Thaler once saying, the optimal frequency with which investors should get their statements is approximately once every 5 years.
We're coming up to the bottom half of the first top of the program, and Chris, I know you have other obligations to go moderate a panel here. I mean, any final points or questions you want to get in before you have to go?
Well, the final point is that we're so glad to have you here, Bill. And as you can tell from the conference, style analysis is alive and well and adding value. So, thanks again for being here. We're very proud to have you here.
Well, thanks, Chris. I'm very proud to be here, and it's a great honor.
Thank you.
Professor, so we're going to continue the conversation with Bill Sharpe on the second part of the program. You're listening to Behind the Markets on SiriusXM 11. We'll be back after a short break.
You're listening to Behind the Markets on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, SiriusXM 111.
Welcome back. This is Behind the Markets on SiriusXM 111. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz, broadcasting from the Hilton in Manhattan. We are talking with Bill Sharpe, a Nobel Prize winner and now a Jacobs Levy Equity Prize winner. We've got Professor Jeremy Siegel at the Wharton School in our Philadelphia studio. And Professor, I know you have some questions that you want to start off the second half of this program here with.
Right. So Bill, Wow. I mean, the efficient markets led to index funds, which I think are one of the great innovations of in the last half century. They've gotten more and more popular. Of course, there's now a little bit of a migration. Is there a smart index fund? Is there a tilt or whatever? I was just wanting to explore, you know, your own ideas on that. Should investors stick with just the lowest cost index funds? Is there any reason to move anywhere else than capitalization weighted or not?
The simple answer is probably yes, stick with broad representative index funds. Try to think about your circumstances, how much risk you want to take, to what extent do you want to invest in stock markets, bond markets, short-term fixed income, what have you. And there's some subtleties. If you work in the tech sector, perhaps you want to underweight tech because your human capital is so heavily in tech. But sort of the default position is start off with the big one. How much risk does it make sense for you to take? And that's, as we were saying earlier, that's a very personal decision and one that's it's very hard to answer that question for anybody.
There's no really right or wrong.
No. It's like, you know, what kind of car do you want? So that's the biggest question. And once you get some sense of that, then I would say invest predominantly in very low-cost index funds and stay with the program.
Okay, let's talk about it. What about now the international aspects? About half the world's equity capital is U.S. Then we have, of course, we have Europe, Japan, a few more developed countries, and then a smaller segment, but an interesting one on emerging markets. Would you just go straight market cap world, or stick more with the U.S. or look at valuations? How would you judge that?
Well, certainly not the latter.
Okay.
I would not try to time the markets by moving in or out of the U.S. versus other countries. You start with the fact that if you look globally, the average investor holds basically what's out there, or the totality of investors hold what's out there. And so a diversification argument would say, well, why don't you put your money at risk in sort of a global bond stock portfolio or mutual funds or ETFs that invest in those, market cap weighted, da-da-da, and then decide how much money you want to put in safe, let's say, treasuries or perhaps short-term treasuries, or TIPS, inflation protected. So that would be kind of a default first answer to the question, and then you would stay with that to the extent that the relative market caps in the U.S. and other countries vary. You would want to make sure you don't get too out of line and keep your bond stocks proportions in line with the market values of those two sectors. But just a very simple, mostly passive, and you can't emphasize low cost enough. Going from, say, 60 basis points, 0.6% per year active portfolio to a 0.1 passive portfolio can make a huge difference in what you'll have later in life. And any possible gains from picking this now and that later, or going to an active manager, are likely to be more than offset by the added costs.
Let me ask a question about this. So we've had a huge trend of that argument pervasively winning over the last 20 years, and now you've seen indexing go from maybe 20 years, 8%. Vanguard, I heard, say 40% now is indexed. I don't know what the exact ratio is, but where would you say we are, and what's the upper limits of how much do you think we can get towards indexing, and does this self-destruct? Does it create opportunities for active? Or, you know, there's actually a good thread of research that I'm reading right now online. Somebody's citing all of your work, this philosophical economics piece. A blogger has been saying, well, indexing is actually making the markets more efficient by removing the unskilled people, people who would have just picked bad stocks or picked bad managers. We're seeing the bad managers lose assets. Everybody's indexing. And so the worst people are now doing it more efficiently and raising the skill for the remainder of people to fight over a tougher competition. I mean, what's the upper bounds of indexing?
The honest answer is I don't know, and my guess is nobody really knows. When we first started down this path, when the whole idea of indexing was characterized by some as un-American, we did wonder, you know, at some point, if too many people index, who is going to be doing the research to make sure that there's some reasonable valuation of company X versus company Y, country Z versus country W, what have you. And people tried to do theoretical treatments of the cost of getting information and embedding it in prices and profiting enough from their active management to pay at least the costs of getting all that superior information. So there's a very, including some people at Wharton, I might say, there's a very delicate balance somewhere. And the question I like to think of it, you know, where is that point at which there is, quote, too much indexing? And I guess maybe I'm just becoming more mellow in my old age, but I guess I don't worry about that problem anymore. The 40% sounds a little high. Certainly, if you look
that,
global.
That might be just Vanguard, which is, of course, the world's leading indexer. Yeah. I don't think across all investors.
Right, and I think, as you all know, once you get outside the United States, indexing is sort of a novelty. It's as if you were back 15, 20 years. So I've decided I'm not going to worry about there being too much indexing, at least for the near future. But certainly one does have to have concern about
that. I agree completely. If there's a natural, if too many people index, then there's going to be all these opportunities for people to do. If everyone indexes, no one looks at how a company's doing. And so anyone who starts doing that is going to do very well. So there's a natural equilibrium.
Yes.
And it's my opinion, given how many underperforming active managers they are, we haven't reached that equilibrium yet. I mean, that is in my gut. I agree with you, Bill, that we might not know what that fraction is. I don't think we're there yet. And I'm not worried exactly, because if we get too many people on indexing, that means those active managers are finally going to make a lot of money and people will hurry back to them. So,
I certainly agree philosophically, but one... one of the many ironies in this whole discussion is that in some sense, if you've got passive investors, indexers, let's call them, and active investors, and if the passive investors get the total market return before costs, then the average active investor will also get the total market return before costs, because collectively they're going to get the market. So it's a very complicated story to try to unravel.
That was the Grossman-Stiglitz impossibility of actually totally efficient capital markets, right?
Right, and it's just the arithmetic.
Yeah.
Which you always
were the greatest at pointing out. I mean, all those aggregation things of what people had to give in all your earlier work, you kept to say, guys, it has to add up
end. Which is a very depressing result if you're an active manager, because if you're going to outperform, you've got to do it at the expense of some other active manager that may be also smart, but maybe not quite as smart as you are.
Well, so. You know, there's this association that there, I mean, and this is, I think, what active managers say. There's some really dumb investors out there that always do, that make systematic mistakes. Now, you know, we could say once we learn them, they should be arbitraged off, et cetera, and so on. But, I mean, there's this feeling is, we're feeding off the dumb people that are doing things wrong all the time.
Well, that's why this intuition that the dumb people are actually going towards passive benchmarks is actually improving the market efficiency
right.
and making it tougher. I mean, I think that's a very compelling argument.
Yeah, I like to ask when somebody is touting an active management philosophy, I say, okay, describe, you know, tell me who the dumb people are that you're trading with while the rest of us stay on the sidelines.
So Bill, so knowing Professor Siegel's background and how he's thought about indexing as well, I mean, he was a longtime low-cost Vanguard indexer, and he still very much believes in indexing. But he also, you know, in his research for the future for investors, he started worrying about bubbles impacting markets like the tech bubble back in 1989, the Japan bubble. How do you and how do you think, or do you think people shouldn't try to address those through these other non-index strategies?
Well, I certainly can't predict them. I know that much.
Yes.
So I should not try to predict and exploit bubbles or the converse. Or, and you know, if in fact you have the ability to see a bubble forming, or you know. A downturn that's gone too far, you know, good for you, but I certainly can, and I think most investors, and I would say also most active managers, can't.
That's why you could have some indexes that can try to adjust on valuation concerns or something like that.
Well, I mean, people have certainly the biggest problem with that whole category of active management is we just don't have enough data. How many real downturns, big downturns, have we had? And, we had one back in the late 20s. Well, the world is kind of different now than it was in the 20s, so you've got such a tiny sample size that it's very hard to know.
Let me follow up on that. It's interesting,
sure.
Bill. You've written some, you know, momentum is often a shorter-term factor, but you've also mentioned that mean reversion there is some evidence in longer term data of then would that argue towards rebalancing, and this is broader because you've often written a lot about rebalancing stock bond ratios. I've talked about maybe rebalancing, you know, maybe PE ratios or some other fundamental ratios to try to take account of some mean reversion. Do you think that there might be something in that?
Well, there's a kind of a subtlety, which you're, of course, well aware of, but if you say if you look at the market values and say, oh, stocks are 60% today in the U.S. and bonds are 40% at the moment, that's maybe 57 or something, and you build your portfolio, let's say 60-40, if you just hold that portfolio, it will move because
stocks move relative to bonds.
Stock moves relative to bonds, yeah. Etc. And if you slavishly say, I will rebalance back to 60-40, then you're of necessity being a contrarian because not everybody can sell stocks at a given time and buy mm-hmm. bonds because mm-hmm. they've got to trade with somebody.
Let me just reintroduce our guest here. We're talking with Bill Sharp and Professor Siegel on the line from the Wharton Studio. I'm Jeremy Schwartz. Sorry to interrupt there, but we just need to reintroduce who we're talking to here.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, what I advocate is that you sort of build your portfolio so it's reflective of the relative market values in the market at the time you build it, and then you sort of tend it so that it doesn't get too far away from the new relative market values. So it's not quite a buy and hold. It's not, say, the Vanguard Balanced Fund, which is slavishly 60-40, because the proportion of bonds to stocks in the U.S. in the last 20 years or so has moved from, I think it's well over 70 to somewhat below 50. So there have been some major changes. Certainly in the 2007, 2009
so you should,
period.
So you're suggesting to let that ratio drift with the actual changes in the market value.
Right. And because bonds tend to pay more out than stocks do, or at least used to back
in
the old days, you know, if you just hold it, you will find that your 60-40 portfolio will in the long run drift up to 70 and maybe even 80. So if you're reinvesting dividends and coupons.
It sounds like this could be a very valid criticism of target funds, and I did want to ask your opinion of
this.
Okay, I hear that. What do you think? I mean, that is it not true that the government actually is a default now that firms can use for the choices of their 401ks?
It's one of three, I believe.
Yeah.
It's qualified, I think they call
yeah.
it. Actually, I wrote a paper a few years ago called Adaptive Asset Allocation, which said if you you can have a glide path strategy. There are other reasons why I have some problems with glide paths, but you need to do this sort of adaptation to market relative values. And yes, the sort of the glide path where you're going to go from 60-40 to 55-45 no matter what, even though there's a 2007-2009, you're gonna move, buy and sell to stay right on that path. I think you can do a better
job. Yeah, stocks went down by 50% relative to bonds, I think.
Which hardly went down at all.
No, you're correct, especially when you do the treasuries, which actually probably went up in price, and some of the speculative ones went down.
So in a sense, all those people, perhaps not knowingly, had a strategy, let's sell winners and buy losers. Mm-hmm. And they are so.
Of course, now with
a constant percentage or a glide path is basically a contrarian strategy.
Of course, now we have to say that given the market bouncing back, that wasn't a bad strategy.
No. I mean, even things that don't work in theory sometimes are great in practice.
I want to ask you. I went back earlier, and I just wanted to clarify because it sounded when I talked about international, and you seemed to agree that if the U.S. is half world equity. That your international equity portion should be approximately half. Did I get the right gist from that, Bill?
Well, if what I would say to be more careful as I should be, if you come to me and say I want to invest in equities, and you're behind a curtain and I know nothing about you, mm-hmm. I would say yes. Once you go whatever the market proportions are, let's say 50-50 or close to it at the moment. But if we raise the curtain and I say, well, where do you live, Jeremy? What
US.
Do you buy?
U.S.
Yeah. Do you buy a lot of French wine? Are you driving a German car? Or, do you buy all American? Outside income subject to what goes on in the U.S. economy more than the French economy?
Well, this is important then. If you're let's assume you're a U.S. consumer. Do you have a recommendation on whether investors should hedge currency risk? If you're,
No, I don't, because I don't know the answer.
Okay.
But that's a vexing question. It's interesting if you look at some of the funds, some of the non-U.S. bond funds include a currency hedge. But almost none, as far as I know, of the non-U.S. stock funds do.
Although the last few years, so we've actually been working on this. So this has been one of our leading.
Tell me, inform me.
No, this is one of my big things I talk about all the time. So we've been talking about currency as uncompensated risk in a way that why you're buying the stocks, you get the cash flows of the. Well, why do you buy the euro?
And it can't be compensated for both parties.
Right.
Right. The deal.
Yeah. So it's certainly added to your risk profile when you look at things like the MSCI EAFE index. Now, the question is, how expensive is it to hedge? Is sort of one of the big things. So emerging markets like Brazil, high cost to hedge because very high interest rate. For Europe and Japan, the developed world, you've been basically paid to hedge from the forward rates over the last 30 years, especially getting paid more
exposed,
now.
Exposed, yeah.
That they're charging 40 basis points to the ECB. We're raising rates. So it's sort of a better than free option in the developed world. So my view is why take on that uncompensated risk?
Well, many years ago, when I sort of addressed this in a pension fund context, the currency hedging costs everywhere were by today's standards very high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And plus you've got the sense that there is a tendency for current exchange rates to mean revert. You know, if they tend to go back a little bit more. If you look at the Economist's Big Mac Index, mm-hmm. you can see some of that. So back in those days, the trade-offs were such that you really didn't want a currency hedge much unless you had a very short horizon. But now, with the costs as low as they are, yes, I mean, I think, and I'm sort of ambivalent. You know, I happen to invest in a hedged bond fund, currency hedged, and not in a foreign bond fund, and not in a currency hedged foreign stock fund.
We'll talk to you offline about that.
But yeah, and so I guess I'm sort of half hedged.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Bill. We commodities as an asset class. We talked about stocks and bonds. We can measure the amount of those outstanding. How do you regard commodities as an asset class, yeah. and how do you measure how big they should be?
Yeah, I remember first worrying about that. Do you measure all the oil in the ground?
Yeah.
Now
Aramco, Saudi Arabia, says it's going to sell, you know, part of its reserves and suddenly on the market. Of course, it was never on the market to you and to me before. This could be billions, if not trillions of dollars, actually. Do you have any sense of how it fits in now to a general portfolio?
The honest answer, very simple answer, no, I don't have a sense.
Okay.
I wish I did.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. Another thing, and I don't know how you regard that, and in a lot of markets, and you know, we definitely see it, like in China, the government still owns huge proportions of a lot of the company. Mm-hmm. Would you include that in the market value, forgetting the total neutral portfolio? We're going to have that if Aramco sells 10% of its, for $1 trillion of its oil reserves. I mean, this is going to be huge, but still retains 90. Is there a natural way to do this, or is it still up for discussion?
Well, as you know, people have tried to build models that incorporate the sort of non-tradable assets. Remember early on we worried mm-hmm. about the fact that a lot higher proportion of asset value was in banks in, say, Germany as opposed to the U.S. So even before you got to the oil in the ground or the Chinese situation, I mean, it's very hard. And I've not seen, there may be, you may know of a study that built a kind of a nice theoretical model that includes that, but I'm not aware.
Yeah, and it's difficult.
Yeah.
Professor, we have the last 2 minutes here, a part of the program. Any as you think about the final closing thoughts with Bill here?
Well, we've covered an awful lot of ground. Let me just ask you, Bill, do you ever render an opinion on whether you think the market is over or undervalued? Is that something you ever look at? Sure everyone asks you. One person said that the first question they often ask a Nobel Prize laureate is what's going to happen to the stock market, thinking all of them should be experts on that topic.
I will. The answer to your first question is no. Yeah. And the second question is, I'll quote Bernard Baruch, who said, when asked that, said, it will fluctuate.
I remember when I remember Bob Solo, which was, he got the Nobel Prize right after that 1987 big stock crash, remember, in October, and everyone was asking him, and he said the same thing, because he said, you know, that's just not what I think. So, in a way, you are still very, I mean, efficient markets.
I am.
Oriented on that, and very limited in terms of rebalancing, although you think there might be some reason, especially for U.S., to do some currency hedging on that.
I've got to wrap it up. Bill Sharpe, it's been such an honor. Thank you so much for being here. Again, Nobel Prize winner and now Jacobs Levy Equity Management Center Prize winner. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you very much, Bill, for being on.
Can Bill speak with Jeremy real quick?
Yeah, hello.
Okay, go ahead. You could.
Hey, Jeremy, that was fun.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we really appreciate having you on. It was great. Thank you. Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll get to do it. You don't go to the FER anymore, do you?
No, I don't go,
conferences.
I'm sort of sitting home doing research and writing most of the time.
Wonderful.
And before you feel sorry for me, I live in Carmel, so
I'm not going to feel sorry for you. That's wonderful, and you certainly deserve to do that. But
hopefully our paths will cross somewhere.
I hope we do. Thank you so much,
Jeremy.
Again, Bill.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.